Less has more than 20 years of experience in high-growth, internet-based technology solutions for high-volume, technology-dependent organizations. He has substantial expertise on the application of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance... I'm sorry. He has repeated success in developing internet innovation centers and positioning Fortune 500 companies as best in class for their technology, products, and customer experience. Les has built 6 companies from the ground up and managed hundreds of employees on a global basis for Fortune 500 enterprises. Please welcome the global CIO of Las Vegas Sands, Les Ottolenghi, to Cloud Computing West.
Thank you. And thank you, Marty. It's a pleasure to be back with the DCIA. Marty mentioned in my past, I've started up several companies. These companies have been, you know, small entities that grew, were much bigger, got sold, and then I would go on to the next thing. I joined Las Vegas Sands 4 months ago after about 2 years of working with the organization. And how many of you are familiar with Las Vegas Sands? Just a quick show of hands. Okay. So you know that we are located not only in the United States here in Las Vegas, but we're located in Singapore and in Macau, as well as Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And with 4 different jurisdictions, we have a number of concerns around cloud computing and data privacy. So those types of concerns extend from the approach that we take in the type of cloud computing we do. Just as a general background, I thought that all of you already know all of these things, so I'll breeze through sort of the level set or the baselining, but it's important for the context of what we have to deal with. When we're looking at international data privacy laws and the different jurisdictions and the compliance and all the constructs that go around the correct choice of process or procedure or technology, we have a bit of a complexity there that extends beyond just one of those questions. So it's not just the data privacy, it's not just the technology, it's not just the compliance, it's not just the behaviors, it's also not just the choice of what leverages up your business. When I joined Las Vegas Sands, the question was not is the company doing well, but how can it perform going forward with the most advanced technologies in a network-centric world, in a digital age where the consumer, even in the gaming and hospitality world, is demanding more and more technology. That is, how are we going to service our customers very well? Well, if we can't cloud compute, guess what? We're stuck. We're going to stay in a 2000 or 2005 framework. And that's a very difficult thing for a company that has as much volume as we do of business. You can read our public charts, our public reporting, but in essence, we are trying to move from where we are today, which is a number of internal systems, to the cloud, and we have to take into account all those additional factors, because if we don't move to the cloud, then again, we may not be able to service our customers properly. So what are the impediments? Impediments have to do with the ones I just listed before. Compliance, data privacy, and technological choices. Now, the slides here are courtesy of Johan van der Driesch, who presented these in Brussels 2.5 years ago. Some of them are. So we're borrowing some of the graphics, but they're good for baselining since they explain cloud computing. However, in definition of what we do, these are the different questions we have at a technical or cloud basis. Do we go to the public cloud? Do we go to the public external cloud? Do we do a hybrid? Do we do something that is completely internal and private? And then around compliance and privacy, what are the things that we have to consider most? Well, in terms of data privacy, a number of the Asian countries are borrowing what the Europeans are already doing or have done. So Singapore copies, for instance, what Germany does. And Macau looks at what other European countries do or what the European Union does. And the United States is altogether different. So now we have heterogeneous compliance, heterogeneous regulation, heterogeneous data privacy questions. UK, Germany, France, They all impose rather strict, if you will, data privacy regulations. And since the Asian countries which we deal in, which are 90%, if you look at our public reports, 90% of our revenue, we have to take into account what happens in Europe. It also means we have to take into account how are European companies dealing with this? What are they doing in the cloud? So for those of you who are providers or technology companies, maybe some of the examples of the business models are best driven out of what happens in Europe. We certainly look there to see how they're handling things. Now, I just spent this last week in Silicon Valley discussing the scope of data privacy and data protection laws and how the major technology players from Silicon Valley can get to the point where they could help us. So how could we get through the concerns in the data protection? And the data protection is just not exactly about the customer. It is about what we do internally with our own employees and also how we manage those systems. So specifically, how do we address each one of our employees and how they touch each one of these systems within compliance and regulation? Yet another layer of complexity, unfortunately. And then with those systems, how are those systems then validated by the compliance and regulatory boards? And then which of our employees can touch those systems that have to be licensed by the data regulatory boards and the compliance organizations, which, by the way, are different organizations and they don't always coordinate. So I apologize for this being so wordy and running off the chart here, but these are all the questions that we have to ask ourselves internally. Do we have purpose-built applications? Do we have trust with the network or the network provider? Do we have, if you will, a strong cloud provider who can store our data in a unique instance? Or are there questions of whether it's being shared? Is it encrypted on our proxy going up to the cloud? Is it encrypted also in the cloud by the provider? All these questions, which, by the way, this is certainly not the complete list, how do those all get answered by the vendor that we work with or the vendors that we work with? And then how do we provision that internally within our own systems? And most of you, I'm sure, have built big data centers or know about big data centers and so on. And then how do we build redundancy across regulatory locations? So the question of data privacy, data protection, regulation, compliance, when you add it across a global perspective or borders, becomes enormously complex. In essence, there are no simple answers. In essence, for us, in a very consumer patron-driven industry or with a focus to our guests all of the time, getting to the question of how to manage data privacy and data protection is essential. We cannot move forward on a global basis in terms of our computing platform until we answer these questions. So, what are we doing? We're working with each jurisdiction, we're mapping out every one of the questions, and we're defining every one of those questions back to our requirements and our systems. And we are able to take steps forward. In fact, we're making some tremendous progress. And there are some things, obviously, I couldn't disclose in that process, but just to tell you that we've spent a lot of time looking how we can be compliant and focusing on the data security issue. The security measures that we've implemented so far in trying to go to the cloud are compliant, but they all have to do with the surrounding systems in our architecture, and that's the place to start. The surrounding systems to the casino and gaming part of what we do. Casino and gaming part is the most critical part, whether it's our employees or whether it's our customers. And once we can answer those questions, then we can elevate and move to the cloud. We do need a lot of help from the regulatory agencies to understand that this is, while not a completely mature set of technologies, is a technology that has the future, that is the only way to run a business or stay in a particular industry. So to not help us move in that direction actually hurts their own cause, which is mostly not just to regulate, but to tax and to regulate, as we all know. They make a lot of money from the gaming business. One of the companies that we've seen that has been making significant strides in helping us actually is this little one up here, which has got a little chrome-looking symbol to it, which is Google. The other company is HP. They're working together and providing devices now that work through multiple layers of the technology stack from the device to go to the cloud only. So I don't know if any of you have seen their latest devices, but this is the new Chromebook that's just coming out. I got my hands on it last week. It's fantastic. I have been a Mac enthusiast for the last 5 years, and I have to tell you, I absolutely love this thing. I'm willing actually to switch. It's that good. But everything that I do is in the cloud that's on this device. And for me to be able to do that, it has to work from the device to the cloud, down the stack of the network layers, right? This is the Chrome OS. And it has to work all the way in a secure fashion with rules that can fit with data privacy regulation across borders in a multiply complex manner. So Marty had asked me to sort of unwind this as a fine wine. I kind of opened the bottle quick on you and poured a lot. So I know we'll get to a panel session, but I just wanted to give you perspective. Economic growth can be impeded very quickly if these matters of data privacy and data protection aren't addressed and addressed in a quick manner. Thank you.
Thanks, Les. We'll get Q&A when we get back to the panel. So that's thank you for opening the bottle. Next up is Greg Nogheim from CDT. I'll read your intro and then we'll get to your presentation here. So Greg is going to take us through the background on the Electronic Communications Privacy Act reform effort. And Greg Nogheim is senior counsel and director of the Freedom, Security, and Technology product for the Center for Democracy and Technology, CDT. He conducts a lot of CDT's work in the areas of national security, terrorism, and Fourth Amendment protections. He's also co-chair of the Coordinating Committee on National Security and Civil Liberties of the Individual Rights and Responsibilities section of the American Bar Association. Greg works to limit the threat to privacy posed by governmental wiretapping and monitoring of internet communications. He was instrumental in bringing together the broad coalition of groups from across the political spectrum that worked to strip overly intrusive wiretapping proposals from the 1996 anti-terrorism law. He has substantial expertise on the application of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, and on the civil liberties protections it affords. Other areas of expertise include governmental data mining, the Patriot Act, which I think had its 12th birthday yesterday, and the state secrets privilege and the privacy implications of aviation security measures. Please welcome Greg Nogheim to Cloud Computing West.
Thanks, Marty. I appreciate it. And thanks to CCA and DCIA for making it possible for me to come here today. As Marty said, I work at the Center for Democracy and Technology. We're a 501c3 corporation located in Washington. We have offices in San Francisco and in Brussels. We like to say that we're dedicated to keeping the internet open, innovative, and free. I'm going to talk about surveillance because it's something that affects cloud companies in particular. And the recent revelations about surveillance by Edward Snowden, I think, have really rocked the industry because it's made it so that people are wondering whether data that they store in the cloud is secure as against government access. It's important to understand for us that there are really two kinds of surveillance regimes. One is intelligence surveillance, and the other is criminal surveillance. Most of what you've heard lately about the Snowden disclosures, they relate to intelligence surveillance. And that's surveillance conducted for the purpose of collecting very broadly defined foreign intelligence information. The authority for this surveillance is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It's the act that the Patriot Act amended and broadened. And it includes the so-called PRISM surveillance, which happens downstream by companies like Google, Microsoft, and Apple, and also upstream surveillance. That means surveillance of the communication stream itself, picking out the communications that mention a target of surveillance. Perhaps most of the focus in Washington has been on the bulk collection of telephony metadata. This occurs under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which amended FISA. What you don't hear a lot about is the bulk collection of internet metadata. And the reason you're not hearing a lot about it is because that practice was abandoned. It went from 2004 to 2011 and was conducted under the Pen Register and Trap and Trace Device statute. The only documents that I've seen about that are a draft Inspector General's report. Criminal surveillance is conducted to investigate crimes. It's under much more focused authorities, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or ECPA, that's for stored communications, and the Wiretap Act for communications intercepted in real time. ECPA also amended the Wiretap Act, but we generally think of stored as being under ECPA and Wiretap Act for real time. The Patriot Act made minor changes to both, but one of the defining features of criminal surveillance versus intelligence surveillance is that the criminal is much more focused and there's less bulk collection. That statute, ECPA, hasn't had a major update since it was enacted in 1986, an eon ago. ECPA reform, the effort to update this statute, is 3 years old, and it's pushed by a group called the Digital Due Process Coalition. It includes major tech companies that might otherwise be suing each other. It includes groups from across the political spectrum that disagree on most everything. You've got American Civil Liberties Union in with FreedomWorks. You've got the Electronic Frontier Foundation supporting the same reforms as the Heritage Foundation. You've got the American Library Association and just a whole range of groups and companies. The companies include AT&T, Google, Microsoft, Apple, IBM, HP, Amazon. It's just a very large coalition that has come together around four reforms. Perhaps the most important of those reforms is to require a warrant for all communications content. Right now, there's a 180-day rule for content held by electronic communication service providers, the ECSs. Once it's over 180 days, there's no longer a warrant requirement protecting that content. It can be obtained with just the say-so of a prosecutor using a subpoena. Even for email that is less than 180 days old and held by an electronic communication service provider, the Department of Justice believes that there's a distinction between whether the email is opened or unopened. For opened email, it says it has lost the protection of the warrant requirement, leaving us with the absurd result that only the junk mail that you never open is protected by the warrant requirement. The reform that we're advocating would also override the distinction between remote computing services. Think of something like Dropbox, where you create a document and then come back and edit it. And electronic communication services, think of something like Gmail, where you're actually transmitting data to another person or to a group of people. Right now, all the RCS data, remote computing services data, which is a lot of data stored in the cloud, is unprotected by the warrant requirement, no matter its age. The reform that we're advocating would require warrants for all of that content. In addition, the group has also advocated for a warrant for location information generated by the operation of a mobile device, like a cellular telephone. It wouldn't matter whether the information is GPS or cell site. It wouldn't matter whether it was stored or obtained prospectively. There'd be a warrant requirement for all of it. The group is also advocating the raising of the standard for pen registers and trap and trace devices. They record information like numbers dialed on a phone and to/from information on email. The result of these reforms would be clarity, certainty, and more privacy. It would also create more trust between users and cloud providers. While ECPA reform is pretty far advanced and has a very solid reform coalition behind it, reform of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, is much newer. ECPA reform has been going on for 3 years. The FISA reform effort has really only come together after the Snowden revelations. It's about 3 months old. It's a coalition in the making. One of the key touchstones of this effort is that it has to protect both people in the United States and people abroad. It's interesting when you talk to civil libertarians, they'll often talk about the protections that are afforded to Americans, and yet the companies in the room will often talk about the interests of people who are abroad, who they also have to serve. At CDT, my organization, our goal is to protect both. We will be pairing reforms that protect Americans with reforms that lift all boats. Perhaps the most advanced reforms relate to transparency and an end to the bulk collection of metadata. Transparency goes to limiting the gag orders that come with intelligence surveillance demands. Company receives a demand, it's not allowed to talk about it. Can't say it received a demand. Government says it can't say how many demands it received. This is an effort to lift the veil somewhat by at least allowing companies to say how many demands they received authority by authority. In addition, there will be an effort to end bulk collection. That means the collection in bulk of metadata about communications instead of just collecting the communications metadata of the target that you're actually going after. The reform that will be introduced on Tuesday would require that the information sought pertain directly to a terrorist or a spy or another agent of a foreign power, a person in contact with the agent of the foreign power, or that it pertain to the foreign power's activities. The reform would extend not just to Section 215, the one used for telephony metadata, but also to the Penn Trap Statute, which, as I said before, was used for internet metadata, and to national security letters, which have been used for both. Another reform would be to close the backdoor search loophole. This is the loophole in current law that allows the government to search through the take of surveillance conducted of targets abroad, looking for the communications of Americans. If they went after the communications of the Americans directly, they would have to get a full FISA court order and prove to a court that the American is an agent of a foreign power. That means a terrorist or a spy or somebody like that. The backdoor search loophole allows for the broad collection of communications targeting people abroad and then searching that data for the communications of Americans. To close the loophole, we'd require a full FISA court order based on this finding that the American is an agent of a foreign power. Another reform would be to insert a special advocate to argue for privacy at the FISA court proceedings. Another would be to require the disclosure of significant FISA court opinions. They are not disclosed today except in recent days and except on a very limited basis. And another disclosure would limit the scope of the surveillance conducted under Section 702. That's the so-called PRISM surveillance. It would narrow the permissible purposes of the surveillance and eliminate one type of interception. It's called the about the target surveillance. So when this law was being sold to Congress, the government said, we want to be able to collect the communications of our targets. Everybody thought that meant communications to and from a target. It turns out the government has interpreted the law to mean that it can collect communications from me to you that mention the target, just so long as they don't know that we're both in the United States. That seems inconsistent with the statute. It's very dangerous for civil liberties. And so there'll be an effort to limit or eliminate the about-the-target interceptions. And finally, We'll be working to put intelligence surveillance within a human rights framework. And what that means is that there are human rights treaties, one of which the U.S. is a party to, that seem to put limits on the type of surveillance that can be conducted, that it has to be necessary and proportionate to the goal of surveillance. And what we're doing is working with some academics and some others to talk about how to deal with international human rights in a world where communications are moving across borders and where some countries, including the United States, think that their obligation to protect human rights ends at their border, even though conduct within the United States affects the rights of people who are abroad. I call this the anti-reform agenda. Perhaps that's a little unkind, but there is also a movement in Congress motivated by legitimate concerns about terrorism to go in a different direction. Instead of outlawing bulk collection, some members are trying to codify it. And this would be the case even though there is as yet no proof that the telephony metadata program or the internet metadata program has foiled a single terrorist attack. Another effort that I'm calling the anti-reform agenda would be to impose data retention mandates on companies to tell them that they must retain the data for years so that the government doesn't have to, and so that the government can come and query the data later. This actually creates more problems than it solves, because the data now available only to the NSA would then become available to state and local law enforcement as well, not to mention the costs that it would impose on the companies required to maintain it and the risks that come with maintaining a lot of personal communications. So what's going to happen? I have a slide here on the status and the timeline. ECPA reform, again, it's further advanced. The agenda is clearer, and the legislation is moving. It cleared the Senate Judiciary Committee and is awaiting Senate floor action. The thing that's most holding it up is resolution of objections by the Securities and Exchange Commission and some other administrative agencies. They argue, hey, wait, we don't have warrant authority. How are we going to conduct our investigations if we can't get a person's email because you've imposed a warrant requirement? And the answer to that objection is that the warrant requirement applies just when the government is seeking the email from a communication service provider, not when it's seeking it directly from the target of the investigation or from another person associated with the target. So that objection, though, has been holding up the legislation and will have to be resolved. On FISA reform, it's fair to say that there's a lot more commotion, but not as much motion. On FISA reform, about 30 bills have been introduced. The bills most likely to move will be introduced this week. One would codify bulk collection. The other would end it. There's going to be a clash between two committee approaches, the Judiciary Committees, which would end bulk collection, and the intelligence committees that would codify it. What can cloud companies advocate in order to build user trust? ECPA reform, and to do that, there's a tool, we'll talk about it later, but it's vanishingrights.com. It allows people to directly contact their members of Congress. They can advocate for FISA transparency, both with legislation, litigation, and administrative reforms. Again, this is freeing companies from the gag that says they can't even say how many surveillance demands they've received. They can advocate limits on the scope of intelligence surveillance and also the human rights framework for intelligence surveillance. These things will be fleshed out in coming weeks. Thank you very much. I'll have more to say later in the program.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks very much for that overview. That was terrific. Next up, we have Tom Hopkins to talk about potential area for technological responses and solutions to mitigate the problem. So Tom is technical product manager on the Rackspace cloud product team, and he has worked in the areas of cloud authentication, RESTful API proxy services, continuous integration, and continuous deployment. Prior to his current assignment, Tom had driven successful application integration projects for several Fortune 100 companies, including Nielsen Media Research, Fidelity Investments, and American Airlines. Tom's current work involves continuous deployment within public cloud, private cloud, and hybrid cloud. Please welcome Tom Hopkins to Cloud Computing West.
Thank you all for the time here. I don't have a slide presentation. I do have some notes. I speak extemporaneously, but only at family gatherings. What I want to go over is, if you will, just to take a telescopic look at this issue from my employer's position, which is Rackspace. And if you don't know, we are a dedicated servers, public cloud, private cloud, hybrid cloud provider. So from the provision of those infrastructures, how our legal services look at this, and then following all of that based on our approach, that you may have some idea of engaging infrastructure providers, the ways that you may mitigate privacy concerns that you have. So the approach that Rackspace takes towards handing over, if you will, customer data to what we call LEAs or any law enforcement agency, whether that's local, state, federal jurisdiction, is in the U.S. And I'll cover the U.S. and then how we take that to our foreign data centers also, is by the Fourth Amendment and by the ECPA, which Greg has talked about. Given that our position is that we do not have either the ability to either look at customer data or possession of customer data in the respect that our customers have the ability to lock Rackspace out of that data, whether it's in public, private cloud, dedicated servers. They have control of their servers, they have control of the clouds, there are identity protections, passwords, etc., so we could be locked out of it. So our position is, by custom and practice, we don't have possession or control of that data. Now, given that it is on our physical data center premises in some cases, and there's an exception to that I'll talk about, we will receive requests from law enforcement agencies for that data. And the four types of requests we respond to positively are search warrants, court orders, foreign intelligence service orders, and or national security letters. Given that, just to add on to that, Rackspace has never had, to date, any blanket warrant or wholesale collection of metadata. We do have quite a large email offering. That's is one of our application provisions. But in spite of that, we have not had, to this date, a blanket warrant for wholesale data collection. And to that end, we also view metadata the same as customer data, that if we don't have possession or ownership of that data. Now, taking this to our foreign data centers, we've set up data centers in London, Hong Kong, and Sydney. And the most discussion on this came up with our Sydney data center, which we just opened 2 months ago, mainly because of all of the recent activities on this topic. And the position we take to that is similarly that we must have a valid warrant type of request from the local jurisdiction. So the question came up, what if a U.S. law enforcement agency requested data from our Australian data center or our Hong Kong data center. And our approach to that is to say that we do not do that, and what the U.S. law enforcement agency will need to do is leverage the mutual legal assistance treaty with whether that's Australia, Hong Kong, or England. Now, given all of that, that still leads to the point where we may receive a valid warrant, national security letter, or foreign intelligence surveillance order to hand over that data. So the mitigating things that can be done in maintaining your data, first of all, is obviously encryption. You know, use it, whether it's personal encryption or infrastructure encryption. Using that between all of your nodes, whether it be load balancers, servers, et cetera. Then in addition to that, if you have storage in the cloud, data storage in the cloud, and you really want to protect that data, what one of the things Rackspace recommends is we will set up a cloud for you, we'll manage that cloud for you, but we recommend to you to make it a private cloud. In other words, set it up in your own data center, give us the ability to go in and manage the infrastructure, et cetera, but because it is in your data center, the warrant would never come to us. So in essence, that's our approach to it.
Thank you, Tom. And our last keynote from Jerry Stegmaier, who is the of counsel at Wilson, Sonsini, Goodrich, and Rossi. He's going to lead a discussion of potential areas for business practice changes to mitigate the problem. Jerry's an attorney in the Washington, D.C. office of Wilson, Sonsini, where he assists clients in matters concerning public and private corporate governance, intellectual property, and internet issues, especially as they relate to privacy, information security, and consumer protection. He also defends related consumer class actions and government investigations, with particular experience preparing such cases for appeal where necessary. Much of Jerry's practice also involves pre-litigation and advisory services relating to business strategy for privacy by design, data protection, intellectual property, and emerging technologies and markets. The International Association of Privacy Professionals has designated Jerry as a certified information privacy professional. Please welcome Jerry Stegmaier to Cloud Computing West.
Thanks, Marty. I appreciate it. And I want to thank all of you for coming out this afternoon. This is something sort of near and dear to my heart that we've been working on for a long time. And I think some of my remarks will be not surprising, and perhaps a few maybe. I thought I'd start out with a question. How many people in the room are providers of cloud or cloud-related services as opposed to buyers? So you sell the stuff. Sell side, hands up. Okay, buy side. All right, so we have a pretty good mix of folks in the room. So before I get started, let me just offer a quick disclaimer. Anything I say to you that sounds smart, thoughtful, or useful, you can attribute to me. And anything that you disagree with or think is pejorative or might reflect badly on you or anyone else, those are not the views of Wilson, Sonsini, Goodrich, and Rosati. They might be my personal views, but I might disclaim them later on. But in the interest of full and fair discussion, let's think about it that way from sort of a candor perspective. And I'll explain in a moment why that's important. At Wilson Sonsini, we represent 55% of the public companies in Silicon Valley and 65% of the venture-backed software companies in the United States. So when you see that slide that Lee put up earlier, or you hear some of the folks talk at this conference, there's a high degree of likelihood that I've personally helped them figure out how to grapple with these issues in one way or another. In other words, the architecture of trust is what I do, and principally I do that on the sell side. So when Lee says, I want to buy cloud computing services, and I think of this way, you never bet against the cloud. You can't. because cloud computing is progress, but yet there are serious issues that we have to grapple. So how do we grapple with them, and where do we get there? And that's really what Marty asked me to talk with you guys a little bit about, which is to say, what are some business solutions? What can we do in the field to address this situation? And I think Greg did something that was really important, and I don't want you to lose sight of it when we get to our town hall discussion. He said, there's intelligence gathering issues, and there are criminal related issues. And I want to suggest to you that I think through the reform efforts that CDT and others are working on, we can address the criminal issues pretty well. That is solvable. But national security is an elephant in the room that is never going to go away. And in that end, it's almost more of a PR and a more practical oriented issue that we've been grappling with for 10 or more years. So in some respects, I'd almost say, let's take national security off the table from a business solution side. Because frankly, if you get legal process, you might be bound by the law to do things you don't want to do. For example, not be able to talk about at all the fact that you have a request. And that is not something that you're necessarily going to be able to address. So as Tom mentioned, you know, sort of from Rackspace, the practical way that businesses are often approaching that now, and AWS has done this, is I'll cooperate fully and completely when I can. But if I can't, I'm still cooperating fully and completely, right? If it's encrypted, I don't have the keys, I don't have it, you know, then there's nothing I can do. Now, I think about cloud computing myself and think about it as one of these issues is really an age-old problem, right? We think of cloud computing being something new and different, but I'm a bit of a humanities guy, studied history, was in a PhD program in history, and I think cloud computing really ultimately comes down to one very simple lesson, historical lesson, and that was Ben Franklin. Anybody carrying any Ben Franklins in their wallet, I hope? It's Vegas, you gotta carry cash, right? Well, Ben Franklin is on the money, and cloud computing ultimately is about money. But Franklin also said something else very thoughtful. He said, three can keep a secret if one and two are dead. Loosely paraphrased. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't want Tom, as one and two from Rackspace, to be dead. We don't want to have to kill him to preserve or maintain the services, nor do we want to do that with any of our service providers that we've identified up there. So what can we do to keep the secrets and yet keep our partners and friends alive and well? So let me walk through the remaining things that I'll talk about sort of in that context. I'm going to talk a little bit about Lee's perspective, and the buy side perspective, and what I see from someone who helps people that are mostly sell side, although I do work both sides of the table. I'm talk about some specific actions, and then I'll give an allegory, a little bit of what I think as an industry we can do from a business side perspective. And then I want to talk about that historical perspective, about one last thing that's sort of intractable, and it sort of goes back to this theme of this isn't anything new. And I'm sure anybody in the room seen the Larry Ellison, you know, quotes on cloud computing, right, where it's like, look, nothing is new. You know, this is just gussed up marketing. It's been around forever. Well, I want to suggest to you that it has been in a different way for these legal problems. So let's talk quickly about Lee and the Sands as a customer, or more generally, anyone out there who's a large organization, multinational, that needs to buy cloud computing services. What are they ultimately concerned about? Well, first, they're concerned that anyone that they trust with their information is going to take at least as good a care of it as they are themselves, and preferably, in many instances, take better care of that information. Now, let's think about that. If you have something that's a really, 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 really important secret, what do? You don't share it. But that's not an option, right? We're still using telephones every single day because we need to use them for business. We still use email every day. So we have to get to that confidence problem. So in order to assuage the concerns of the buyers, they need to feel that at least to the extent that they could protect the information, you will protect it in the same way. And in fact, I think much of the time in cloud computing, you can do a better job than they can do because you can scale infrastructure. So how do you do that? Well, I think the first thing that you do is you have to have demonstrable, repeatable information security. The ability to walk the walk and talk the talk, right? So at the end of the day, foreign intelligence and law enforcement requests are legally grounded, right? And maybe even some of the surveillance is extra legal. But if you heard what Tom talked about, the methods and mechanisms, really he's talking about having a process. And so whether it's ISO 27001 or some system where you can say, look, we're going to deliver the best security in the world to the folks who are the buyers. In fact, we're going to deliver security that's better than they can provide on their own. And why are we going to do that? Because we have more customers. We can do it at cost and scale. Now, the second thing that is different, I think, with Snowden, and beyond this, you know, we're going to have great security, is there's this paradigm, and some of you may have heard it, but the gist of it is this, that you can have security without privacy, but you can't have privacy without security. And that's a real conundrum that we face, because as businesses who are cloud service providers and working in this space, we have a very specific challenge now, right? We know national security requests are not going away. In fact, we suspect they're likely to go up, because as people share, they use that Franklin model, you know, one, two, and three, now know, if you are someone who's acting in your national interest, you're going to use all the tools at your disposal. But how do we address that as sort of a service provider? And I think in that regard, there are two things that people do. One is you can be active from a public policy perspective. You can work as a group, and that'll be the parable that I'll talk to you about in a moment. But just from sort of a simple perspective, one company isn't going to solve this. Frankly, all of the cloud computing companies together might not solve it. But what is the problem we're trying to solve? It's frankly not a cloud computing industry side only problem. It's much bigger than that. It is, how can we limit government and other people's access to and use of information that we need in order to do business and to function? And when we conceptualize it that way, that's very important. Because if you're a cloud computing company, you might say, well, gee, I've got, you know, half of the Fortune 500 are my customers. How do I enlist them? How do I enlist those CIOs to come out and help make the case that the key obstacle to broader widespread adoption of this technology, which we believe will deliver better security, is concerns about something that we can't do anything about directly, right? National security, those elements. So that's one piece. The second piece, and I think Greg sort of addressed this and Tom addressed this, in a specific way, but I think it's a way for you to sort of focus on, and it's new, which is process. So I've written hundreds of privacy policies, and I've helped 50-100 companies, some company, all mostly companies even that you would know, figure out how to do the following. What do I do when the government comes and asks me for stuff? And in 2001, I represented the American Libraries Association when the Patriot Act came out. And I did what I thought was the hardest project to date I've ever done ever, which was to summarize how the Patriot Act changed federal surveillance law. And it really made my head hurt. And there are things that I think still remain unanswered questions, like what is content or non-content, right? The last time I checked, a URL, you know, Good Times in Vegas is addressing information, but there's a content element that's there, and that actually gets treated differently under the law. We got plenty of assurances from the government, by the way, that we didn't need to be worried about that. But what happens is the people will come and they will ask. And what's different in the wake of Snowden and all of these types of things is that the buyers, right, Lee and the Sands, or anyone who has a large amount of information stored in the cloud, those companies are now increasingly asking, when someone comes and they ask, what are you going to do? Now, what did Tom tell us? I'll rephrase it in slightly in the more lawyer way. Tom said, well, we're going to explain to them that this information isn't in our care, custody, or control, which is the legal standard typically for production in sort of a discovery context, right? So they use encryption, they use different tools. But the architecture essentially is built around this idea of being able to say, I'd love to help you. We are committed to cooperating. By the way, you're always committed to cooperating with the government. But I can't, because we don't have it. The second piece though is having that process. And a lot of companies in the last couple of years have started to focus on putting into their contracts, if we get one of those kinds of requests, we'll notify you promptly, right? So you've all seen those confidentiality provisions that say, you won't share our confidential information ever and ever, ever, never, ever, never, ever, ever. And if you must, before you do that, you'll call us and you'll give us an opportunity to contest it in court. And so it's often done through John Doe and similar kinds of suits and complaints. So two things, right? Two actions, two takeaways that we as a community. One is, if you're on the sell side, have good security, have it be demonstrable, repeatable, replicable, so you can walk the walk and talk the talk. Second, have processes in place so that you can demonstrate to your customers how you are on their side, that effectively by sharing with you, they are sharing with themselves, and if they trust themselves against the government, there's no reason why they couldn't trust you. Now, I promised two more quick examples, and I want to thank Marty and the folks, because really, this really had me thinking a good bit about what's different here, right? How are things different? And I want to suggest to you that I don't really think that this is new. There's an old Supreme Court case called Miller from the early 70s. Any other lawyers in the room? I think we know we got one. So there's a Supreme Court case called Miller, and it articulated something that's called the third party doctrine. And Franklin would really appreciate that, because the gist of it is, when you share with someone, you no longer have an expectation of privacy in the information that you've shared. Now, I don't know about you, but I tend to hear that and I go, well, that's BS. I talk to my wife every night. I hope that she'll keep my confidences. And I talk to my clients every day, and I know they expect that I'll keep their confidences. And the rabbi, ooh, I hope he keeps my confidences, right? But what did the Supreme Court say? Well, the Supreme Court said of banks that when you transacted with your banker, and I'm speaking loosely, you gave up an expectation of privacy. And much of what the Digital Due Process Coalition is trying to restore, I don't want to say undermine, but essentially strike a practical balance in the notion that we need to be able to share with other people in order for things to work. Now, when I said nothing is new, what happened? Well, the Supreme Court came along and said, no expectation of privacy, and quite promptly after, the Right to Financial Privacy Act was passed, which imposed very specific procedural requirements on how people can get access to and use your banking and other financial records. And I think coming out of, you know, Snowden and some of these other revelations, I think we're going to see those kinds of things come into place. Two last observations, and I know we'll talk more about this in the town hall piece. One is, if you're a buyer of cloud computing services, software as a service, platform as a service, you're not getting bespoke clothing. You know, for the most part, you're getting something that is off the rack. It might be configurable, but it's off the rack. And if you want something that's bespoke, that costs a lot more money. And what am I trying to teach, right? This is to Marty's request about things that are actionable. If you are a Fortune 100 company and you're interacting with a leading cloud service provider, one of those kinds of folks, and you say, well, I got to send my team of 34 auditors out to your place, and I want you to complete this 600-page questionnaire, and we're going to come in and inspect your facilities whenever we want, and we're basically going to treat your facilities like they're our facilities, because you know you want our money. Most of those cloud providers are going to go, no, that isn't how we do business. And they're going to be very respectful about it. And the only way they're going to do something different is if you have a significant number of zeros after your term sheet. But what this means on the buy side, and I think this is really, really essential, is that in Lee's scenario with his, you know, client situation, how do we deal with, you know, law across and all these matrices? You have to be driving enough revenue for those companies to say, it's worth it for me to do all of the work to incur the transaction cost to work with you. So I hope this has been helpful for you. You know, I think one final thought, and I'm kind of a word picture guy if you haven't got a hold of that already. So any Discovery Channel fans in the audience, kids, anybody ever seen zebras cross the Nile? Right, what happens when we cross the Nile with the zebras? Any ideas? Correct. Big, large crocodiles who make very nice boots, I might add. So when the zebras cross, here's typically what can happen. If you're the first zebra or you're the last zebra, the croc has a much higher chance of getting you. Or if you're a small zebra. So if we want to all survive, and I think it's important to think of ourselves as zebras in terms of our privacy interests and our collective interest in this area, you stay together and move quickly as a group. And that's on the buy side and the sell side in both the public policy realm. Because at the end of the day, the sellers of the services want the buyers to view them as another member of the herd, right? My stripes might be white, your stripes might be black, but at the end of the day, we're all zebras. And if we do that and work together as a group, I think we're going to be able to tackle these challenges. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks very much, Jerry. So we're right on schedule. Let's do a stretch break and go down to the exhibit hall, which is where, Don? Gross. All right. Don Buford, Executive Director of CCA.
Thank you. That's okay. when we make these hotel arrangements, we don't always see the places that we suggest for the little informal gathering. And we chose the Vesper Bar just because someone at the hotel said, we said, where's a good place for people to get together after the sessions? And they said the Vesper Bar. We didn't realize and didn't think about the fact that there's going to be a World Series game. And I just went to the Vesper Bar, and they've got a little TV. So we're going to call an audible, and we're going to go to the Q Bar. Now, the Q Bar, that's the letter Q. You go down the escalators to the first floor in the casino. You follow the yellow brick road, and it's the first bar on the left. You'll see it. It's got like 15 widescreen TVs, and that's where we're going to meet instead of the Vesper Bar. But now, you're welcome to go down and grab a cup of coffee or soda, a quick refreshment in room 8, which is the fourth room down here on our left, and then we'll reconvene back here in about 15 minutes.
We're going to hopefully have a little fun now and get to hear from everybody who's here in a fun way. But let's start with our two new guys, Peter and Larry. Start with Peter first. Just give us a little bit about what your company does and what your interest is in this topic today.
So my background has primarily been in the entertainment industry. Years and years back, I started writing and creating intellectual property, namely songs. And songs and music, ironically, is one of the most complex sets of rights and issues surrounding content at large. And careful what you wish for, I remained independent and wound up controlling and owning a lot of rights. And then I was faced with the task of managing those rights. And although I tried to find third-party solutions, I wound up coming to the conclusion that there really wasn't a comprehensive platform that would handle everything that I was dealing with. So I ultimately wound up developing DigiRamp, which is Digital Rights and Management Platform. And we're actually about to launch this technology, which is both a PaaS and a SaaS. And what's ironic is that through my personal needs in the exploitation and business and distribution and storage of all of the content and rights involved, it's led me into a whole new world. And thanks to Marty, I've actually taken a necessary and great interest in what everybody here is about. And I'm very, very appreciative to even be included. And thank you, Marty.
Larry, how about you?
Yes, I'm one of the lawyers in the group. I started out as a commercial lawyer, although that was many years ago. I was at a DC law firm that did a lot of commercial work for telecommunications companies, and this was back when telecom was opening up to competition and dramatically changing, and basically converted from a commercial lawyer working for telecom companies to full-time telecom lawyer, and was doing that for a number of years. I went from lawyer to business executive and went to become president and CEO of one of our telecom clients for a number of years and helped them build a network and helped them articulate a strategic plan. And part of that strategic plan was incorporating technology and broadband together, and which really for that company was the precursor for a cloud computing deployment, which today that company is now deploying. And as the executive, I helped lead that rollout, and now having come back to Washington as their lawyer, I'm helping them with a lot of the issues, not only from a business side, but from a legal side, having to deploy their cloud solutions. A few years ago, I came back to my old law firm. I was a partner in a communications boutique. We got merged in 3 years ago with an international law firm, which is now known as Edwards, Wildman & Palmer. And our firm overall, we have a very active regulatory practice and a huge privacy and data protection practice, which specializes in these issues as well. We have a big M&A practice. We do a lot of private equity and venture capital. We probably represent most of the top PEVC firms that are doing work in the cloud or fiber or data center or telecom space. We do a lot of intellectual property work, a lot of telecom and cable regulatory, and our interest is somewhat holistic in working with cloud companies generally to kind of find solutions for the range of problems for a successful deployment.
Thank you and welcome. So to me, the best and highest use of the rest of this time will be for us to kind of have a brainstorming session on really these four issues that we laid out to begin with. One is the impacts or a sort of problem definition of what are we talking about here with what is really broken with the government, you know, putting $35 billion of our international business at risk and the other privacy and security concerns. And then, you know, what kind of legislative or regulatory reform can we look to that would actually help us? What kind of technological fixes can we work on? And then what kind of business practices could we change or standard setting could we do? So why don't we start with a panel first, but be thinking, and let's do it this way. Come up with one legitimate concern, one true problem of end users and providers regarding government surveillance of data, or if that's too narrow, you can make it, you know, privacy, security, and a little bit broader. Just one, and we'll go down and get these. If somebody else chooses yours, pick another one. And then we'll do the rest of the group, too. Les, what, just a legitimate concern?
Legitimate concern is how we stay in compliance. That sort of entire chain of trust that was being described a little bit earlier that we would have to comply with, and how to model that from a technological point of view and employ that in process and practice. The question around, or the suggestion around, you know, demonstrate that you can do this over and over again so that the regulatory agencies are comfortable. They have really a lack of education. What I found is that they lack certain sophistication and understanding what are the questions around cloud computing and what you have to do in order to maintain data privacy and still be commercially viable with your business. And that lack of sophistication is, I think, I don't think it's deliberate. I think it's just an outcome. And I also think, though, it is an enormous barrier because it gets mixed into other issues. The issues are not well segregated or defined. So it would be simplicity, clarity, and a path forward in terms of education for the regulatory compliance organizations so that commercial enterprise can keep moving forward.
Okay. Greg, a legitimate problem.
How do you decide whether to challenge a surveillance demand that looks fishy? It looks like it's overbroad, you're not sure, it looks like it's asking for something that maybe you shouldn't have to produce. How do you make that decision?
Good one. Tom?
I would suggest the need to get away from what I would call the spy versus spy escalation of technology. In other words, our customers come to us, people come to me personally, wanting to know how to up the encryption, how to up the fence around the data, as I mentioned, private cloud, et cetera. But those technological advances will be eclipsed by other technological advances, and that's what I call the spy versus spy. And I think there needs to be a resolution in the policy arena.
Escalation, right. Jerry.
I'm going to react quickly to Greg and put the sub point on his, which is also not only how do you challenge, but how do you pay for the challenge? Because so many of these companies are fast growth companies, and the economics of a challenge makes the decision. In other words, we don't even get to the how do you decide when. We get to how much does it cost. But my item, I would say, is interoperability. And for those of you that haven't heard this, it's how do we achieve interoperability between competing legal systems where we recognize mutual respect for systems that aren't quite exactly the same? Because I think it's one of the biggest trade issues that we're facing.
Okay. Peter, a legitimate concern as a customer or as one of your vendors?
This is two-pronged, but it's one point, and I guess I could sum it up by saying accountability of definitions. Somebody, I think it was Jerry, raised the fine line between information and content, and that's what I deal with constantly, especially when if asked to provide something, say from a warrant, I'm actually breaking a law by doing so. It's called copyright protection. Mm-hmm. And if I'm distributing content upon request, furnishing, I'm literally breaking the Copyright Act law. So where is the accountability for definition? Where do those exist? Who regulates these types of terminology that everybody uses? FISA, I don't even know whether there's a standard in this area, and it's daunting to somebody who both stores and distributes other people's content.
Larry.
One point I'll make with sort of two dimensions, macro and micro, and the point is how to reconcile the conflict between the almost evangelical zeal, particularly in Europe, for data protection and stricter standards versus the needs of the industry here to grow and flourish and operate. And the micro point is, historically, many of you are familiar with the safe harbor protection, which has been a way, as a practical administrative approach, to sort of handle it. That is now absolutely in jeopardy, and to the extent it is in jeopardy and on the verge of being thrown out, that provision, which would allow companies to sort of reconcile that conflict, will, and if it does not remain viable, it will require companies to sort of start from scratch, either in reforming their contracts or coming up with other arrangements to reconcile that conflict between the demands of European regulators and U.S. law.
Thank you. Okay, who wants to go first? Mike, I'll walk this over so you can be on the record.
Thanks. My name's Mike West. Most of the data that I deal with, like Peter's, is media, okay, storing it, transporting it, moving it around, letting people see it, et cetera. But I want to try and get from the point of view of what we're talking about here, government surveillance, et cetera. What is the data, and how much do you have to retain? Let's say a data center somewhere has received a piece of data. Do you have to log when it was received? Do you have to log the IP chain that it came down when you received it? Or is it just the data that they can go off? I know with cell phone records, there's obviously time and place are pretty much in there, but in a data center?
Well, I think there's a question between what the government requires you to retain and what you might retain for business reasons, right?
You fell for it. You're answering it. Let's hear some more problems first. We'll get back. Who else has a legitimate concern about government surveillance of your data?
Looking to add to our consumer product backup storage and encryption of that storage and backup services. There's providers that offer, so consumers are going to lose their encryption keys. They need the ability to retrieve those. Is there an advantage of going with the service outside the United States that may not have to turn over those encryption keys to the consumers? Or In the US, has the government asked for encryption keys for storage services in the past? Do we know?
Right, so if I heard the issue, it's best practices for...
Which country is the most, restrictive? Let's go there. Other concerns you want to put on the table? Not looking for solutions.
Are there concerns about having to give up encryption keys for consumers?
Right. I represent a vendor providing data transfer technology, and I've had two experiences recently, one in Europe and one here in the States. In a European cloud conference in London, a lot of the European cloud vendors were promoting the fact that their cloud platform was not here in this country, and that therefore they were not subject to the whims of the our agencies. And another experience I had, so a flag right there, right? Are we competitive globally now with our government watching over everything we do? And another very similar conversation was with a Chinese official who was visiting the country looking for technology for their media distribution business problems. And when it came to security, he looked the CEO in the eye and said, is your technology secure? And she said, oh yeah, it's secure. We've got this and this and this. And then he repeated the question one more time. He said, but is it really secure? Because I understand in this country, people are watching. So I guess the concern is, is the NSA helping us globally, or is it
no irony,
preventing us from competing globally? Because we're facing on the business side these issues.
Good one. Anyone else? Chris.
Yeah, my name is Chris Bolker. I just got a, I guess it's more of a comment than a question, but it's interesting now that security has been highlighted after Snowden. But yet, from an industry standpoint, you know, our kids have been, you know, taking pictures of, you know, of themselves in compromising, you know, positions, and that gets automatically uploaded to the service provider as a backup from their mobile phone. All of your Google Mail is parsed so that they can help advertise better. You know, security from an industry standpoint, it's not just the government. It's actually the corporations and other entities that are actually trying to access that metadata to better serve you, location information, whatever it is. And there are no standards today, I don't believe, from what can and cannot be used. Therefore, contracts are the most important piece. And I don't know if you saw South Park recently, they did a pretty interesting episode about Kyle, you know, signing away his life for Apple when he when he uploaded the software, but it's those type of things. Nobody reads those agreements when you say accept blindly, right? So those are contracts and they're binding. But what are your comments about not just the government, but also the other industry players in from a security standpoint, and actually this generation who's used to not really caring that much about their security?
Now you can go. You can answer any of the questions that were raised or anything else.
I can answer the last one.
You want to tee them up maybe one at a time?
All right. Who wants to answer Mike's question first about...
What is data?
Content?
What is data?
How long do you have to keep it for? So you start to answer it, Greg.
Oh, yeah. That I don't think there's any rules. Maybe there's some rules about some particular kinds of data. But generally, mm-hmm. there's not a rule that the government imposes that you got to retain data or that you got to log it. There may be developing rules about how well you have to secure it. The Federal Trade Commission is starting to say that maybe you have to comply with some security measures. But so far, there isn't a data retention mandate on U.S. companies.
Yeah,
there are data retention.
U.S.
In the U.S.,
there are data retention
say,
mandates abroad.
The information goes everywhere. So it depends which jurisdiction you're in. And where your data center is, and if you have control of the data center yourself or
right.
not.
Right.
Which
so,
leads to the next question, which was, which your opinion of which country might be more secure than any other country right now?
The United States is the most secure, in my view, for a very specific reason. If you want to find the best privacy and data security in the world, you find an American company that does a lot of business in Europe with American lawyers. Because American lawyers take the law very seriously, and as Les suggested, we take process very seriously. And when you combine those two things, given that we're going to try and comply with European law, hands down, right? I mean, the elephant in the room in all of these discussions, and that's why I said interoperability, is if you think that the Chinese or the Mossad or any other intelligence agency doesn't do all of these things, you know, the French, been around, it's not a new problem at all. And that's why I said not to be an apologist. So the quick answer is choosing geography to address national security concerns is not a path that I would recommend for any of my clients. You know?
Yeah, I think we get that.
One question was raised there. You raised jurisdiction. In the United States, are the laws across the entire nation, or would it vary from Nevada to Utah?
Depends on the, yeah, it depends on the industry and depends on the data set, right? It can be different.
Okay. We get, let's kind of move on from this one. Yeah, what he's got to say.
One thing. When it comes to government access for criminal purposes, ECPA, the federal rule, essentially sets a floor. A state can provide more protection, but it can't provide less.
Right. Okay, next topic is what should we, the cloud computing industry, customers or providers, look to the Hill, look to Congress to do to help us? And let's start with Larry. We'll just go right down the road and then we'll do the same thing again.
I would go back to the macro-micro paradigm idea. I think they're going to have to solve right now this like growing revolution, particularly in Europe. And there have been talks about European companies touting themselves as the better solution. There's a level of indignity that seems to be going really strong right now. And there's probably some misinformation associated with it. It's ironic, among other things, that the thing that's sort of triggered it, which is the fact that the NSA can get information or subpoena or gather information one way or another, is sometimes less onerous than some of the laws of those own European countries that allow their intelligence agencies to gather the same or more information. So cool heads are going to have to prevail at a policy perspective, and this is going to have to get solved, and that would be probably at some sort of congressional or international sort of level. On a micro basis, I would just say you have to relook and monitor this really closely right now. And again, if some of the provisions that allowed you to kind of skate through this are no longer valid, and if we don't at a policy level solve this problem, then individual companies are going to have to relook at those agreements and their data protection protocols to ensure that they can do business legally in Europe.
Peter?
Real briefly, I'm interested in who polices the police, because the NSA doesn't really have anybody, checking them out, and hopefully we can put into legislation tools that may apply, but it still doesn't necessarily make them accountable. How can we complain about something that we don't know about? And I don't know what the answer is. And if you create a regulatory board or whatever vehicle there is to implement that, does that mean that they then need to be regulated? Or they need to be monitored? It's infinite. But at this point, there's nobody that is really being held account, or there's no one to account to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Two, I think, thoughts. The first is I always vote with my pocketbook, and I've been watching what we've been able to accomplish legislatively and from the executive branch on everything else, on things that are far more pressing for most Americans, and I think we're not solving those issues. So if I have a dollar to spend, I would be spending my dollar, if I'm in one of these companies, 80 cents of that dollar, 90 cents of that dollar on my architecture, my systems, my infrastructure, so that I can say to my customers, you know, we're the best that exists. There isn't a better alternative unless you want to keep everything in a shoebox under a bed. And we know, you know, you don't bet against the cloud, that's not going to happen. But the second piece, I think, and this is to modify a little bit sort of what, you know, Larry suggested, that doesn't mean we don't all engage in ensuring that the discussion happens. And so I would reframe what Larry said, in other words, what is vigilance and involvement? I would say that is pushing with your congressional representatives, pushing with the Department of Commerce, pushing with the Federal Trade Commission, that this is a very, very serious international trade issue. And Commerce already gets it, and they've gotten it. You know, interoperability, I didn't make that up. 3 years ago, I went to a State Department delegation, and I said, what's our message? And they said, interoperability, interoperability, interoperability. But you know, we need to keep the government accountable. And that's where that 20 cents on the dollar would go.
Tom, what can the Hill do for Rackspace?
I think to key off on that, the engagement and the discussion, that the discussion that does happen is an open discussion, that the laws, modifications, reforms, whatever comes out of this is openly seen, and it's understandable by specifically by us as an industry. If we come to agree that two entities can communicate privately between each other without the caveat of a warrant, then we can enable that. But we need to know what the process is, and we need to know what the rules are, and we need that discussion to be open.
Okay. So, Greg, what do you think we should be asking you to be driving for?
Look, I think that it's important that policymakers, with that 20 cents, hear from companies about the costs of surveillance to their business and to their business model. I don't think that it's been internalized yet. I don't think that they get it. I don't think that if you ask 20 members of Congress, do you think that the intelligence surveillance is costing jobs or costing U.S. companies business, I don't think half of them or a quarter of them would know that that's happening. So I think it's important to get out there and say it. Part of what we do is give you opportunities to do that. We'll keep working on doing that. But I will say this. There is some reform that is pretty far along, this ECPA reform in requiring a warrant for content on the criminal side, that is doable and that I think would be very helpful to companies and, frankly, helpful to privacy as well. And somebody asked earlier, what's content, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just so strange. In ECPA, the criminal statute, content is what you think it is. It's the substance, meaning, or purport of a communication. Now, it does get a little tricky when things that are used to address, like a URL, include something that has meaning, like possibly the URL for this event. But it's not completely strange. In FISA, content is defined differently. It doesn't mean that. It includes with whom you spoke. But that's not right. That doesn't seem right. So there is some mystery in the definitions. Congress ought to clear up a lot of that so you can do business without having this cloud hanging over you.
No pun intended.
Yeah.
Les.
Well, again, governments go at 1 mile an hour. Business goes at 200 miles an hour in a internet or network-based world. And so that disparity, if government were to do something better, is to find a format, a footprint, a framework, an approach that would be more contemporary with how and where business is going, where commerce is going. Otherwise, all the other discussion points around what inhibits commerce will become more effective and unfortunately slow down and ratchet down the global economy in certain respects. And as a result, I think then the best thing a government or governments can do is to assume that their own institution definition is not appropriate for this particular environment. And they have to find out another format, another means by which to address it, including starting with education and finding a common vernacular, and just a common understanding of what data means, these laws or make the tax codes look very simple. So the fact is that, you know, if we don't do that, then the problems become much larger, then they become their own problem. They become their own size of problem. And then we ask for big solutions rather than a lot of small solutions all along the way.
Okay. Other thoughts to put on the record for what we as an industry want Congress to do for us about this problem? How can they really help us?
I'm thinking.
Hey, Marty.
Go ahead.
While they're thinking, I just had one observation, which is it's interesting to me that as this debate has unfolded with the Snowden scandal and the NSA, that, and this is just an observation, not trying to get into political debate, that we have, you know, one of the more liberal presidents in the last couple decades in office who has vigorously and unflinchingly gone to bat to defend the right to for strict laws to enable the government to monitor and wiretap and eavesdrop. So I think that, among many other things, sets the framework and the parameters for what the challenge is going to be to move anything through the political system, at least under this president.
And one of the cost questions that came up, you know, I don't know if you guys know this, but Google is being sued for wiretapping to the tune of, what, $100 billion, something outrageous. I actually have the little figures on it, accused of wiretapping. It turns out this charming story of seeing a dead relative on Google Street View might not be so charming after all. Google's been accused of wiretapping in two separate cases and has been merged into one massive lawsuit focusing target ads in Gmail, which plaintiff says is in breach of privacy wiretapping laws. Worldwide users' cause could also present long-term consequences for Yahoo, Microsoft, etc. Billions of dollars of possible liability. It's as much related to commerce, private, as it is public and government.
This is the craziness of it. There aren't any really good, effective definitions here. There isn't a lot of mature thinking. I mean, Google's also been sued, and I think you're just referencing it as well, when they take, in other countries outside the United States, they take pictures of the streets, right? They're sued in those countries for a violation of privacy. The whole idea of data management and privacy is much bigger than Snowden, much bigger than the NSA, and there is not a full symmetry to looking at that issue. And that governments to sort of halfway step in and say, well, we're going to defend our rights here, we're trying to protect our country, and you have the irony of Germany making, you know, these problems about the United States doing spying and so on. It's just, it's absolutely off the mark as to what really data management and data privacy is all about.
But there is a trade policy issue there for us in the industry, I think. And I think Les is sort of spot on, which is, and I'll suggest for each of you, the very novel proposition that information is the asset class of the 21st century.
Totally.
And if we agree with that assumption, and then we start to behave moving from that, and by the way, that doesn't mean that everyone can own information, and the lawyers here will say, you know, that's a toughie. But having rights to use it responsibly is something that people don't disagree on. We have a global worldwide consensus on that. It's in the details where things, but if we approach it as an asset class, it makes a lot of the other decisions and how we behave pretty easy to think about what the answers are.
Do you have anything else to ask the Hill to do for us this year?
Legal minds. So far we've been talking about data privacy and these policies. We've kind of had this tone where we've been looking at the government and other potential people that would breach the data privacy as these bad guys, et cetera, they shouldn't be messing with our data in the first place. But I'm wondering, especially when you guys draw up these data privacy policies for your customers or clients, do you inform them of like what, they should already have some sort of responsibility of what they are and aren't going to be transferring in terms of data, and should already know what types of potential breaches could come as a result. And I'm wondering if you guys have discussions with your clients on that, or if there's already some type of inherent knowledge.
Well, at least one of those companies has "Don't be evil" in their, you know, as a mantra, and it hasn't helped them from avoiding, you know, that kind of stuff. But I use, and full disclosure, you know, 55 of my former colleagues work there, and we have a great relationship with them. So I think it's a little more complicated than that. But what I think at a baseline, you know, most companies, it's a pretty straightforward, you know, framework, right? Trustworthy, loyal, helpful, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. I missed one. If you come after the event and tell me which one I missed, I'll buy you a drink just to see if you're paying attention. But that's a framework for how to behave, right? Because if it doesn't fit into that, you know, we say to the clients, don't do it, because most of the time there is ambiguity in the law. But what you should do is often pretty clear.
Okay. Did you miss lawful?
Later.
That isn't one of them.
All right, let's combine the last two topics just in the interest of time, which were, okay, forgetting what we want from Congress or regulatory bodies, but what can we do ourselves that would help us the most on this issue? Let's start with Tom on this one, and we'll go down and come back. In terms of either technological solutions or business practices changes.
So there are two issues. One is in your personal use, and other is in infrastructure. And when I say personal, I mean if you're a business and your emails, et cetera, versus building an IT infrastructure to process your business. And again, encryption on all of that, all of the way around. There are several available services now that would encrypt end-to-end communication, whether it's your emails, text, chat, voice, everything. An interesting side effect of that that I've heard come back from some of these outfits are that by the mere use of this extra encryption level of security, it raises a red flag where they may not see that one-on-one encryption, but they see that you're using it, and then the social observation of why is this guy wanting to do this kicks in at times.
So you're saying we should all be zebras then?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right.
Right? I mean, so it won't stand out.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. We need to go at this en masse. And then infrastructure, again, encryptions, certificate level encryptions everywhere that you can. And in terms of the ownership, if you're really, really wanting to keep this data within your fence, that using a cloud service provider, set up a private cloud, do it in your own data center. The cloud service providers can manage, spin up that cloud for you. If you're using the continuous integration methodologies that go around cloud, doing it in a private data center shouldn't matter whether it's a public or a private cloud.
So Jerry, what can your clients do to help themselves?
Well, I'm going to steal from Tom the tinted window paradigm, I think, because I think that's just a great way to think about it if you're individually using encryption. I'm going to call that the tinted window paradigm. You know, that's a probable cause stop. So I think I said it in my talk, but I really think I think about it in the context of less, you know, which is if you're a service provider, how can you get your customers comfortable that the data will be protected better in your hands than if they were protecting it themselves? Because at the end of the day, you know, that's the juice, the oil that's going to make this little car go. Because people are practical and they say, well, their security is better than ours. You know, if the government hacked our own servers, what's the difference if it's a third party? Maybe it's better. So I sort of come to that.
Peter, what could your cloud vendors do to sell you more stuff?
I would just say make the terms of service real, real clear. You know, to just expect people to investigate on their own, and then and after it's too late to realize that there's issues, to really walk clients through and help them understand what they're dealing with, what liabilities they have, what liabilities we have.
Okay, good one. Larry?
Pretty similar follow-up. I mean, I think we're seeing this now with new co's that we're talking to in this space, sort of making lemonade out of lemons, and sort of instead of shying away from these security and privacy problems, and instead of hoping it will go away, they're going 180 degrees the other direction, so they're being proactive, putting it right out there. And from both a technological perspective and a regulatory perspective, they're embracing it. They're having honest conversations, which I think is what you were sort of saying, with their clients, and trying to sort of carve out a niche, honestly acknowledging some of these conflicts and the fact that some of the questions don't actually have perfect answers, but touting themselves as the best and most reliable partners to solve them. So I think we're seeing it in the industry right now. Now, that's one of the responses I think we will see, and I don't think it's a bad idea. particularly when you have certain verticals, as in some of your other conferences we've looked at, that are highly regulated right. anyway.
Les?
Yeah, I mean, I can just echo what everyone has just said, okay. and I agree with that. And anything that, and from a service provider that can be of assistance to navigate the issues and the complexity of those issues across multi-jurisdictions.
Okay. Anybody else have anything to add? Just one more, Chris?
Yeah, thank you for this conversation. I think this is very, you know, needs to be done. Hopefully it will be done in Congress, not here. But
not a chance.
I was actually a member of the U.S. Cloud Commission for Leadership in Cloud Computing. I was one of the deputy commissioners, and we had 71 companies, and NIST was there, and you know all the relevant folks, including the Commerce Secretary. And are you guys working with the Tech America Foundation? Because that was the Cloud 2 initiative that we did in 2011. I think this is the biggest thing that came out of that commission was trust and transnational data flows with the two big gaping holes. And I did a lot of work on the infrastructure side. There's really no standards built yet from a cloud perspective. And I think that the legal side was totally neglected. I don't know if that was a political thing or what, but I think this is an opportunity for associations like this to get together and perhaps, you know, bring those types of folks in, and then we could bring that back.
Are you suggesting there is a lead and they will follow?
Yes.
Maybe. We're almost out of time. We don't want to miss in case that umpire gets wiped out by a guy from Roxbury. The first one. So, Greg, would you close us out with what can we do with the to help on this on the Hill with the VanishingRights.com effort?
I think what I want to do is talk about zebras, because really that's where we are at the end of the day. It's important. I know that a lot of companies, whenever we try to get companies to be active on something, the first question we'll get from the company that we've approached is, what's everybody else doing? And everybody's always asking the same question. Nobody wants to go first. Finally, we get somebody to go first, and then everybody goes together, and we end up with a powerful effort. I wouldn't abandon hope and say that Congress isn't going to do anything. They do things, and sometimes they do things that hurt. And part of advocacy is preventing bad things by pushing for good things. Things that will be coming up soon, ECPA reform, and a way to get active on that is to join this Digital Due Process Coalition. It's free. And you get to hear about what's going on ECPA reform. Another way for individuals to get active is to go ahead and log into VanishingRights.com and click there, and there'll be a tool to help you contact your member of Congress about this ECPA reform effort. Long term, we have a big challenge because different countries are doing different things, particularly on intelligence surveillance. Long term, I think there's going to be some move towards some level of harmonization. It'll either help you build trust or it'll make users and customers more worried. So I think, although it's a long-term process, that the time to get engaged in that process is now. Thank you.